This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. Henry Hughes is a writer, a professor, and a fisherman. Not necessarily in that order. Not that you could easily separate those elements of his biography. They run together. They inform each other. They're tangled like bad fishing line. Hughes has written four collections of poetry. His new book is a memoir called Backseat with Fish, A Man's Adventures in Angling and Romance. It's a series of vignettes from a childhood on Long Island to teaching gigs in Japan and China to his current life as a professor at Western Oregon University, and to riff on a modern classic, Fishing Runs Through It. Henry Hughes, welcome back to Think Out Loud.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
You have a passage in the middle of the book about the thrill of feeling a fish fighting on the other end of the line. I thought we could start with that.
Sure. Thank you. Even after 1,000 times, even now after the 1,000,000th time, from the hook through the line and rod into the body and mind, fish thrill. There's a thrill in the chase. Tackle and boat preparations the day before, early rising and stalking, setting or casting lines, the hopeful repetition and careful adjustment, the waiting. And then the big thrill of the hit, the rod bent and jumping with the living power of the fish. Fish thrill us with their struggle to survive. It's a human pleasure that doesn't translate into anything else except animal wildness. Like cats and killer whales that toy with their living food. And the worst forms of human cruelty, where someone enjoys the long struggle and suffering of his victim. Even in hunting, one hopes for a fast, clean kill. In fishing, the greater the fight, the greater the thrill. Nice, my friend Tim would say, with a grin, when the hooked bluefish made a panicked dash. It may be barbaric, but anyone who loves to fish loves the sensation of a struggling creature. The blues jumped and ran and eventually came to the boat, snap-jawed and yellow-eyed.
This is a really – it's a startling paragraph because in a sense you're comparing yourself to at least in one very particular respect to a kind of evil serial killer. I mean the only other humans who enjoy this, you know, the struggle of prey as it's being killed. It's a shocking paragraph to read in its own way.
It's worth thinking about these things.
Do you think about that when you're fishing?
I do sometimes. And maybe that makes me a little bit different than some anglers. But, you know, 30 million people bought fishing licenses in the U.S. last year. A lot of people fish. And I'm just trying to be honest with, you know, why I enjoy when that rod bends and that line is tight and there is something alive on here. Now, I also like to eat fish. And rather than buy it in a supermarket wrapped in plastic, you know, I'm feeling the fish. I'm out on the water. I'm experiencing the elements. I'm learning about the fish. And I'm touching it eventually.
It is – I mean, it does make you wonder, would you enjoy fishing if you didn't have that the thrill of feeling the fight on the other end of the line? If you do everything else you're talking about, the preparation and the thinking about what kind of lure or fly to use, then you put it in the water – and then, you know, at a certain point, there's a fish on it and you just haul it up.
That wouldn't be very much like life, would it? Or nature. There's a lot of tension and a lot of struggle. Even gardening is full of death and destruction if you do it well.
In what way?
you have to
Am
weed.
I growing my tomatoes
well,
right?
Well, you kill insects, you weed, you manage. You know, I'm not trying to over-romanticize any, you know, savageness in fishing, but I'm real about what I feel. And I think the engagement with nature is really important to me and to a lot of people. It comes at certain consequences. And I do wrestle with this all the time.
Why do you think fishing in that sense is different from hunting? It's something that you note in that passage, that this is not the way people think about hunting, where the struggle of the deer and the suffering of the deer in its own way is a part of the thrill. A clean kill, I think, is more the hope.
Sure. And honestly, when we're harvesting fish, we do have to get them in. So if you're using, you know, line, you need to actually let some line out. You need to play the fish. Otherwise, you'll lose him, right? So part of it is actually catching it.
The logistics of actually bringing it onto the boat.
That does occasion this struggle. But when it's brought on, if I'm harvesting a fish, we kill them very quickly. That's kind of the code of anglers now. So there is that. But you're right. The end game is different. And there's also catch and release. Now, that even complicates things further. For example, on certain rivers like the Metolius, our beautiful Metolius, it's all catch and release, fly fishing only, okay? And so here you've got anglers actually fishing only for the pleasure of, hooking and fighting and landing a fish. It's released. So that really is a little bit tricky.
There are a couple ways to look at that. One is that ethically, if you're thinking about sort of the different categories of harm here, it's better because you're not killing the fish. It seems like you're also arguing that there's another way to look at it, a darker way, which is that nor are you putting it through all of this unhappiness and terror to eat it.
Right.
It's purely for your own sport.
And in fact, in some countries like Germany, it's actually illegal to catch and release. But we do it for good reasons. It's a conservation measure. And when done carefully, when you handle the fish properly, Hemingway talks about wetting his hands before handling a fish in Big Two-Hearted River. Really, good care. There's, I think, a pretty good survival rate. But it's a question, you know.
The fish from that passage were bluefish, which is they're all over the world, but not in the Northwest as far as I know. But they're all over Long Island Sound where you grew up. Is there any fish like bluefish in terms of the fight in the Northwest?
Absolutely. Salmon are fantastic fighters, as are steelhead. So when you're talking about big, strong fish or pelagic fish like tuna, bluefish are kind of shaped like jacks. They're the only species in their family. But you've got, fish that can really turn it on. And any fish can fight depending on the circumstances. And again, use light line to improve your casting abilities, but also in some ways to create that art of fishing. And that, again, raises yet another question.
Let's move on to your beginnings, though, because we could spend the whole time talking about fights. But there's a lot in the book. When did you start fishing?
From a very early age, and as I describe in the book, my father is not a fisherman. So it wasn't that kind of traditional father-son mentorship. But he was a good dad, and he liked boats and outings, so he was supportive in that way. But I had this crazy desire to get in the water, and I love like the mystery of water. You can't see what's down there, especially fishing, right, deep water. It's just like, what is down there? And then you drop this line, maybe a little bait, and you feel this tug. It's like this wonderful, fiber optic cable. You're picking up these signals.
You note that that your mom was not an angler, not that excited about fishing. I mean, less excited than your dad was.
Yes.
But that you write that she helped make you a complete angler. What do you mean?
Yeah, and this is an important theme in the book, this female power of mystery and suggestion. She would say wonderful things. I mean, ask me wonderful questions. My dad was much more practical-minded, but she would hold up little lures out of my box and say, well, this is beautiful, and put it to her ear. It would make a nice earring. And part of it as a kid, like, well, that's kind of weird. But now I realize it was really a charming and interesting way of making larger connections. Fishing to her had beautiful, pieces to it. And she would ask, she said, try grapes. Why don't you use grapes, for flounder? And I said, oh, my goodness, But in fact, I caught a trout once on a grape.
You took eventually her suggestion after poo-pooing it?
At a winery once here in Oregon. Yes, and it worked.
Why do you think your parents encouraged and enabled your love of fishing when neither of them really cared about it that much?
They saw it as a good activity, that it brought me closer to nature. And this is a big issue, right? Like Richard Louv's, Last Child in the Woods. We're talking about a new wave of technology and that kids may be like nature deficient. So they just saw it as a good thing. And I learned a lot. I had books on fish. I was fascinated by the biology of fishes. We'd go to museums and aquariums. And so they saw that as a healthy activity. I was engaged in nature.
Your mom died of a brain tumor when you were only 13 years old. It seems like a particularly difficult age to lose a parent when you're mature enough to really understand what you've lost, but maybe not mature enough to process it fully. What was your life like in those years immediately following her death?
Yeah, it really kind of shattered a lot of illusions that I had about the world. And I sharply felt mortality, which I always felt with fishing. When you use bait or you kill fish. But when my mom died, I was like, oh my goodness, this world is full of death. And it changed me philosophically. I became much more of a, transcendentalist or a naturalist. And so I struggled with religion after this point.
Before that, would you have said you were Christian?
Probably. I was definitely asking big questions, and I loved things like evolution, which challenged some of the values of some of the Christians in our community. But after her death, I really found that nature was indifferent, but no less beautiful and no less powerful to me. It was just a different journey.
Did your relationship to fishing change?
It became even more intense.
In what way?
Well, the life and death aspect of it, and even challenges, even dangers, became important to me in a way. I'm not saying I wasn't afraid to die, but being out on the water and being in a risky situation somehow made me feel very much alive, as it does for mountain climbers or cyclists or anyone who takes a little bit of a risk in an outdoor activity. And I feel that just the physical sense of being alive when I'm fishing.
What were the biggest risks you took as a fisherman?
Well, as a young man, I was very foolish, and there's a chapter where my father berates me fiercely for taking a very small boat out into very rough water. We never wore life jackets, and then in teen years we drank and went out on the water, and so I'm much more careful. But certainly even wading a steelhead river, a coastal river in Oregon, you know, can be very tricky. You got slick rocks, you're in your waders, you're trying to get a little further, make that cast, and, you know, sadly, anglers every year die, but, you know, this is life. We need to get out there and have adventures.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking right now with Henry Hughes, who teaches literature and writing at Western Oregon University. His new memoir is called Backseat with Fish. You mentioned steelhead rivers. You wrote, "Steelhead may be the sexiest game fish in the world, and it's taken me a lifetime to find them." What makes steelhead the sexiest game fish in the world?
They're very beautiful. When a steelhead returns from the sea after 2 or 3 years and enters our coastal rivers, they're just a gorgeous silver with these blushes of red, and they're streamlined, and they're difficult. They are hard to catch, and, you know, fly fishermen love to fish for them. I think everything about steelhead are beautiful, even the lures and flies that are used.
Well, I talked to a guy who was fishing on the Sandy River a month and a half ago when we did our On the Road show on Highway 26. And he said that summer steelhead in particular are infuriating and amazing because they're so hard to catch. Do you end up enjoying fishing more if it's almost impossible to actually land a fish?
Sometimes. I have put in long days and not touched a steelhead. I still enjoyed those experiences. However, it's nice to go out rock fishing off the Oregon coast and catch 7 of them.
Fill your pail.
Fill your pail. So both have their roles.
Is there such thing as a bad day fishing?
Not unless there's an accident or something goes wrong. But no, it's almost kind of like a proverb, right? Like, oh, you know, a bad day of fishing is better than a good day at work. You know, guys will say that to you. But I just love being out on the water. And I do fish longer than most people. When someone says, well, let's go fishing, I'm like, okay, well, it's not a whaling voyage, but be ready, you know, for an 8-hour day. And like, really, 8 hours? I'm like, well, you'll see.
Does that weed people out? I mean, if you say that, some of them say, all right, I just want to dip my toe in. I'm not going to put in a 9-to-5 here.
They'll go with me once and they'll be like, I don't think so. But thanks anyway. I'll take some fillets.
One of the points you make is that there are as many kinds of fishermen in the world as there are people. There are quiet fishermen and loudmouths and meticulous people and sort of sloppy ones. What are you?
Maybe all of those things. I'm not specialized. There are a lot of great anglers whom I admire who make fly fishing only. And I love fly fishing, but I also love, you know, bait fishing on the bottom. I love sturgeon fishing. Just a few hundred yards from your studios here at OPB, there's great sturgeon fishing. You know, I do it all. Trolling. You name it. So I'm diverse.
You put a lot of pages in the book to fishing for carp, which you did in the Midwest. You did it in China. You've done it in other parts of the U.S. as well. But it's not necessarily a fish that a lot of Americans care that much about or talk that much about. What don't we know about carp and why should we pay more attention to them?
Well, we have a lot of game species that are in some ways more dynamic. Maybe people think, and it's subjective, that, you know, steelhead is more beautiful than a carp. But when I got to Japan and China, I realized not only is there a storied tradition, but these fish are actually great fighters and they can be delicious. And in fact, the British fish for carp quite enthusiastically. So for some reason, America deemed them trash fish, but they were actually brought to Portland at the turn of the century to be raised. It was going to be the new fortune. It never worked out. But these fish were released into our system, and some environmentalists bemoan this, these invasive species. But boy, do we have a lot of carp in the Willamette system. So, you know, you can try carp fishing, and they can get huge. You know, 30-pounders are not uncommon in the Willamette. So I think they're just a misunderstood fish.
If we are going to rid the Willamette of an invasive species and have some fun while doing it, what's the best way to prepare a carp?
Yes, indeed. Well, you'd want a smaller specimen so it has less accumulated toxins.
Biotoxins, yeah, right.
But the Midwest tradition, and I had this in Asia, is to simply scale the fish, scrub it well, you know, gut it, clean it, scrub it well, and then score it, cut down to the spine, and deep fry the whole thing. You know, a fully fried, like wok-fried carp will curl up, turn golden brown, a nice little sweet sauce on that. And that's actually a fine-eating fish. They raise carp, of course, around the world. And this is a, you know, we're missing out on a carp, I'm telling you.
Now, we've been focusing on fishing, and there's a ton of fish and fishing in the book. But there's also a lot of the ways in which fishing relates to your personal relationships. Why write a book in which those two are so intertwined?
Well, they genuinely were. I had girlfriends who liked fishing or didn't like fishing, and time issues in any relationship, right? You put in a lot of time on something. I put in a lot of time on fishing. I'd hope that my female friends would fish with me. But certainly the two were, as you said, tangled sometimes. Maybe braided is if things are going well. But it was just a part of my life. I never really read a fishing book that went into it in such detail. So I said, let's talk about it. I think fish are sexy too.
In what way?
Well, I think there's something dark and mysterious and wet and wonderful about, you know, the piscine world. And so – and I, when I studied literature, I found all these interesting examples of Shakespeare punning on sex and fish and Ovid's great line, you know, about, you know, always have your line out in the water. You never know when you'll catch a fish. Our language, right? You know, lots of fish in the sea, and even adolescent jokes about fishy smells and so on. So, you know, there's a kind of, you know, sensuous – wet, salty, wonderful world that I think is connected to our sexuality.
One of the themes that runs through the book is that you had a kind of catch and release approach to your own relationships. It seems that it's more often that that's what people say about you than what you say about yourself throughout the book. Is that, though, in retrospect, the way you would describe your dating style before you became a married man?
Well, I definitely was not monogamous. I mean, I wanted to experience, you know, a lot of things and people. I did in my 20s, and I'm honest about that in the book. And I know we take a risk when we do that, but I felt it was important. And yes, I have been accused of catch and release. And then, you know, girlfriends would speculate on was the loss of my mother responsible for my inability to get serious, or do men have issues with, you know, marriage or, you know, security. And so I try to confront these questions.
Do you think that those girlfriends were right when they said that the death of your mother when you were only 13 had a role in your anxiety about committing?
I think that's quite possible. I do. And also, I loved adventure. And I have a great relationship now, and it really it feels right, but it did not in my 20s and 30s. I enjoyed the company of my partners and had long-term relationships lasting a couple years, 3 or 4 years in one case. But I wanted to keep moving. I wanted to travel. And that's just, you know, here we are, you know.
I wonder if you could read us a paragraph from the end of the book.
Certainly.
About sort of a summation about fishing.
The endless repeated promise of fishing, the hope that the next cast will be the one that connects you to a fish, a magnificent fish, the fish of a lifetime, can lead to a hobby, obsession, addiction, healthy emotional and physical persistence, the faithful practice of something like religion, even passion and love. It has to leave somewhere. The craft of angling is the catching of fish, the writer Ted Leeson wrote after wading these same Oregon rivers. But the art of angling is a receptiveness to these connections, the art of letting one thing lead to another until, if only locally and momentarily, you realize some small completeness, and then you start over.
What's your next fishing trip?
I would like to get involved in the white sturgeon, which is a wonderful local fish, and do some sturgeon fishing, but maybe write a book on the sturgeon.
Why white sturgeon?
They're the largest North American freshwater fish. They're these incredible dinosaurs, live right in our city, and they're also in a bit of trouble right now. They're experiencing their numbers are dropping, and there's a couple different reasons, but I'd like to look into it.
Have you – and you said earlier that you already caught one.
I have caught several sturgeon.
What does it feel like to catch one of these white dinosaurs that are right in our city?
Well, I've caught them maybe up to 200 pounds, and it's just an incredible battle.
How old would a 200-pound sturgeon be?
At least 50 years old, maybe older.
So you might be catching a fish that's older than you.
Yes, quite possibly. That's interesting, isn't it? It's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, to meet nature on different terms.
Henry Hughes, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, David.
That's Henry Hughes, a poet and English professor at Western Oregon University and the author of the new memoir, Backseat with Fish. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to take up the real-life ethical quandaries that programming driverless cars entail. As in the case of an accident, should your car be programmed for your safety or the safety of the people around you? If you don't want to miss our shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our nightly rebroadcast is at 8 p.m. Thanks very much for tuning in today. I'm Dave Miller. We'll join you tomorrow.